Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books and East European Studies podcast series. I am your host, Amanda Jean Swain, at the University of California, Irvine. Today, we'll be talking with Jessica Greenberg about her book, After the Revolution, Youth, Democracy, and the Politics of Disappointment, published by Stanford University Press. So welcome to New Books in East European Studies, Jessica.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
As a more detailed introduction, I wonder if you would tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in the region of the former Yugoslavia, and specifically interested in youth activism and democratic transition.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So my interest in the region, my interest really in questions of socialism and post-socialism goes back quite a ways. I'm sort of what you would call, if, you know, Alexei Yurchak has referred to the last Soviet generation, I'm sort of the correlate last Cold War generation in the U.S. And so, you know, I remember very distinctly, and I think it had a big impact on me, 1989 and the events leading up to 1989. But I also have enough of a recollection or sort of sensibility of that Cold War world that structured our everyday life in a lot of ways leading up to 1989. And so by the time I got to college in the early 1990s, I had really become fascinated with questions of socialism. What was it? What did this whole world, what did 1989 mean in a more global sense? I don't know that I had the vocabulary for it at 18 or 19, but there was a sense that something had happened that had profoundly shifted the grounds or the terrain of politics in the world we lived in, and I was really interested in that. And so my first interaction with the region was in 1996, in my junior year abroad. I spent a summer in a volunteer group in Pakrac, Croatia, in Croatia and Western Slavonia. And it was essentially a peace and reconciliation NGO that did a lot of work on the ground in an area that had a ceasefire line running right through the community. And so that was my first exposure to the wars of Yugoslav succession. Again, I was in college at the time, and I had come to the region as part of a longer trip in a study abroad program where I had been thinking about questions of socialism and gender and post-socialism. And so that was my first interaction, and it was a very profound wake-up call. I mean, for a kid from the suburbs, you know, to suddenly find herself in essentially an immediately post-conflict zone was incredibly destabilizing. And so it really sparked for me a number of interests and concerns politically and also academically about what had happened and what was this place that I had spent that time. So when I went back to college, I became involved in a number of NGO efforts and feminist advocacy efforts. And that's what initially then led to a more professional engagement in the region. I did some NGO work after college, between college and graduate school, working with a feminist advocacy organization called STAR, the STAR Project, that worked across the former Yugoslavia. And it was from there, I had done some work with the Network of East-West Women. And so it was from there that I generated my scholarly interests in questions of politics and advocacy and social movements.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting, that combination of the NGO work and the scholarly work. And I think that really shows up in your book. So I'm sure we'll hear more about that as we're going along. But to start, can you give us a brief overview of Serbia's democratic revolution in 2000 and what you called the day that the spirit of the revolution died, which was March 12, 2003, when Prime Minister Zoran Didic was assassinated.
Yeah. So, you know, there was a lot of protest and activism on the ground throughout the 1990s. And I detail in some of the chapters of the book some of the preceding kinds of opposition and student movement action that you saw across the 1990s. Some of those earlier protests were more confined to discrete or smaller groups. The largest in the 90s were the 96-97 protests, which I do talk a fair amount about, which really had tens of thousands of citizens on the street who were protesting basically stolen elections across the countries, and particularly in urban areas. And those were really protests that sparked somewhat broader social movements. So you had a series of sort of oppositional and youth protest organizing, and that was really sort of the beginning of a real flowering, or the sort of culmination, I would say, actually, of a flowering of opposition in Serbia in the 1990s. And it was also that turning point that then produced a somewhat more internationalized, you could say, and more broad-based social movement response. And that's, of course, Otpor, and which many of the listeners will probably know the most about if they know anything about Serbian political resistance in the 90s and 2000. And so it was really that movement that then culminated. There was something of a pause during the NATO bombing, where organizing went somewhat underground for a variety of reasons I touch on a little bit in the book. And it really springs up again around 2000 with the elections that Milosevic called and his defeat by the opposition parties. And when he initially refuses to step down, it's really that period of time between the elections and eventually when he is ousted on October 5th that you see this massive groundswell of popular resistance against him. And again, that was a movement that was much more generalized, right? So it had these older elements from the 1990s. It had the oppositional aspect. It had the student movement piece as well. And people have been organizing for many, many years in a more sort of micro level networked way. This was really a groundswell movement. The question, so that was 2000, October 5th, 2000. Which is sort of the moment of Serbia's revolution, and of course becomes a model in interesting ways for subsequent color revolutions as well that happen in other parts of the formerly socialist world. Whether or not that was a revolution as such, right, still remains a pretty heated debate in contemporary Serbia and elsewhere. We can talk about that later if there are questions about defining revolution, because that's obviously a big thrust of the book, is to think about what it is a revolution means and to whom and what it means to define it from certain kinds of perspectives. But I sort of begin with that moment by thinking of it as a common reference point around which the conversation of revolution emerges. There is a moment, a real sort of, again, flowering of, call it a sense of hope, a sense of possibility. I mean, I think that, you know, people look back and the sheer force and power and generative energy of that moment was in many ways a surprise, not to people necessarily who've been organizing all along, but I think it was a sort of surprise. You know, people didn't expect that necessarily from Serbia. And then relatively quickly, as I talk about in the book, there was a beginning of a sense of, or trying to make sense of, what does it mean? What did this moment mean? What did it really translate into? What does change really, really look like? And that period of kind of possibility but questioning really comes to a close with Jinjitsu's assassination. And in many ways, although he was a controversial figure while alive and wasn't always necessarily popular, if you look at the polling, certainly, his death for many signaled a moment where all of that questioning, the possibility, the openness of the period subsequent, immediately subsequent to the revolution, begins to kind of shut down, right? And so you have a combination both of a very formal marker that people could really point to and say, take stock, right? Well, what did this mean, right? Especially with Jinjitsu, what did this mean? And you have a kind of figurehead who stood in very symbolically and to some extent in policy terms as well for that shift between the sort of revolution and its aftermath. And then you also have the beginnings of a kind of political shift in the opposition in Serbia too, which people may or may not be interested in excruciating detail, but you certainly, you have a period of a sort of state of emergency. You have people becoming increasingly aware, although I think people mostly knew, but in a more sort of public way, of the continued influence of organized crime and the institutional and state apparatus that had so structured Milosevic's authority through the 1990s. And so there was a sense of both a loss of possibility and a kind of awakening to the complexities of what a democratic revolution means in practice.
Great. So tell us more about youth activism specifically during this time and this process of revolution. And I think it would be useful to talk more, and I'm sure we will, about how to define revolution.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in particular, the three groups that you worked with and were the student activist organizations that are the key part of your research.
Right. So there was, as I indicated earlier, a lot of youth organizing and activism, and it's a little bit hard to disaggregate different groups because there was also a tremendous amount of overlap. So what you'll tend to see for people who are familiar with the literature on the region is a lot of focus and analysis, and rightly so, on NGO or non-governmental organization activism. And these groups are really interesting as well to think about. They're not explicitly youth, at least in the 90s and even leading up after 2000, there weren't as many groups as I think there probably are now that have a real youth component. There were often sort of, for example, youth sections of other kinds of groups, or just groups, organizations that happen to have a lot of young people. But the NGO groups didn't tend to organize as much around particularly youth or student thematics. So there was a sort of very rich world of anti-war activists, feminist activists, general civil society organizations, and who were networked and connected both within Serbia but also across the region. So there was a real sort of trans-regional and also transnational focus as well to a lot of the NGO efforts. And again, as I said, they attracted a number of young people, but they didn't necessarily organize in terms of a youth thematic. I was interested in those organizations that were really primarily thinking and organizing in terms of a somewhat more self-conscious youth or student focus. And I was interested in that for a number of reasons, both because the question of generational difference across political activist groupings was interesting to me, and the role of generation and the role of youth, and has continued to be interesting to me even now, as you still see these very interesting modes of differentiation, often very micro-level modes of differentiation among generations, right? So even between one group to another over the course of a few years, right? Things break out in these interesting kinds of generational ways and cohort ways. But I was interested in these themes of youth and generation, and I was also interested in the particular role of the university as a very contradictory kind of institution, as a site in which people, and I talk about this in the book, in which people were really encouraged or had been encouraged to some extent to organize and think critically, and also as a site of very specific site of repression under Milosevic, and also as a place where people were trying to think through new kinds of citizenship, particularly around new moments of economic transition, right? So people were concerned both with questions of freedom and real social questions. They were and sort of anti-repression movements, and they were also concerned with things like employment, right? And the sort of weight of the contradictions of those different sets of commitments were really interesting to me. So my that was one reason that I focused primarily on these student groups. Another reason was because they were so instrumental in organizing, and universities were such important sites of organizing throughout the 90s and 2000 and just after. And so the way I sort of framed my questions, two ways. One is a question of sort of what do you do? You've been on the streets, right, for years and years. And some of the students I work with have been protesting since they were 15, 16 years old, really, had come of age as a generation around protest. And I was really interested in what it looked like and felt like to move from the streets back into institutions, right? And how one takes a more anti-authoritarian politics, you could say, and works it through institutions that at times can be really authoritarian, right? I mean, for those of us who've taught, we, you know, classroom mm-hmm. is always to some extent a little bit authoritarian, well, pedagogical anyway. So mm-hmm. within that framework, I was interested in, so one, student organizations and their relationship to the university and to institutionalized modes of democratic organizing and practice. And two, differences among organizations regionally, but also in terms of their understanding of what democracy meant, what student activism meant, and what their responsibilities were and to whom, right? So the three different organizations that I worked with had very different, they overlapped in some cases, they had different histories. One was more particularly student union, which I did the majority of the research with, and is really the main focus in a lot of ways of the book, was much more international, had a stronger presence in the European student movement, and that developed over time and was really very rich and robust at the time that I was in the field. SAVA's student association was interesting because of its political positioning during the 1990s. It was understood to be pro-regime, and that sort of, you know, shifted around the late 90s after 2000. And it also was the legacy of the official student organization under socialism, right? So that had been that SAVA had always had a sort of official relationship to the university. And then the third organization I looked at, I spent a lot of time with them. I write about them less in the book, Association in Niche. I was interested in because of a sort of their regional presence and the regional component. But what I was interested in across these three organizations were a number of things, their style of work and even just things like the organization of gender relations. But I was really very much interested in how each of these groups was articulating democracy. So what did they think democracy meant? What did it look like? What was evidence of democracy? What did it mean to represent students? Who were they responsible to, right? And how did that sense of ethics or responsibility or representation manifest itself in very specific sets of practices? The way organizations were structured, the way leadership was structured, the way in which finances were handled or carried out, the extent to which they dealt with rank and file student issues versus policy kinds of advocacy, right? Again, their relationship to international groups, their relationship to other NGOs. And for me, I found the differences among the organization illustrative, both because I was interested in the organizations, but also because they seem to work along very different models or understanding of democratic practice, but to be manifest in really material ways, right? Really practicable and material ways. So that was the rationale behind situating myself both at the university and with student groups as opposed to the NGO world, which I had had some more professional experience with, and also to try to sort of put myself in different conversations across the three groups.
Mm-hmm. And I think your conversations with individuals is a really compelling part of the book, that you're able to get at these experiences through very specific individuals. And What struck me was just the frustration with the practicalities of living at this time period in Serbia on the part of the young people that you're talking to and the students that you're talking to. And you say that they had had enough of utopia, whether it was socialist, nationalist, or revolutionary. And that as a result, Serbian youth were really present focused rather than future oriented. And this seems like a very important temporal shift in the way they're thinking about their activism. So can you talk more about that?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. No, I think that's exactly right. It was a sort of frustration. And again, you know, keep in mind, even just sociologically and ethnographically speaking, these are students who had been through a lot. They had come of age in the context of the Milosevic regime and ongoing wars, and also hyperinflation, which was, you know, the worst that Europe had seen. I mean, massive hyperinflation. I mean, they were kids. I don't want to call them kids in a patronizing way. They were, in many ways, they were young adults who had experienced in a short lifetime a tremendous amount of instability and upheaval. And so I think even on a sort of practical level, there was among many a desire for things to just function, right? Things to just, again, be normal. And this is something I've talked about. This is something lots of folks who are scholars across the region, activists across the region, have talked about, this sort of desire for something that would be predictable or normal. And at the same time, a kind of emerging sense that an older generation wasn't going to guarantee that those conditions for normalcy or predictability. And so they had to do it themselves. If I were in a different line of work, you know, if I were in a sort of social psychological vein, I would say, you know, they were a parentified generation. And that's not necessarily the kind of language we'd use in anthropology, but there was a sense of competence, the necessity of competence. And actually, it's really interesting, and we can talk about this maybe later. I'm seeing that, and I've been talking with friends in Serbia, and just recently co-authored something with a friend about a sort of a competence generation that's come of age, and particularly in relationship to who's doing the service work and advocacy work right now for the refugees, in terms of the refugee crisis in Serbia, right? This sense that your parents' generation and the state, even though they ought to, aren't necessarily going to make things work, and we have to make things work. So this is not to say that it's not a hopeful generation or an idealistic generation, or there aren't other ways of being activists that are creative and deeply imaginative and prefigurative, right? And that kind of politics is also absolutely going on in Serbia and across the region, and others have documented that really, really beautifully. But I was interested in the practical responses, right? The sense of practicality, or as I call it, pragmatism, right? Or a politics of disappointment as a kind of guiding ethos, right? So we have to do it. We've got to be competent, and we have to take this on, because if this change is going to happen, then we're going to have to undertake it. And again, I think it makes a big difference that the political and social materials that people were using to structure a sense of everyday competence and functionality for the state in a post-conflict and post-socialist context and, you know, post-Milosevic context were institutional materials, right? They were looking at things like policies, procedures, regulations, course evaluations, right? The materials at their disposal for world-making, right, in many ways were very practical institutional kinds of materials. And I think the paradox for me that was important is that there's a tremendous amount of creativity in the use of practical materials in the pursuit of world making, you know, and that was something I wanted to get at with this sort of notion of anti-utopia. Again, not at all to say that there isn't creative, imaginative work going on both within these groups and among other kinds of activist circles in Serbia and the region, but I wanted a sense of that commitment to the pragmatic as, again, as I've been saying, a kind of world making, a kind of ethos.
Mm-hmm. And it really changed the way in which they thought about protest and revolution. What is revolutionary in terms of their move from that kind of almost stereotypical kind of activism to the processes that they were engaged in very practical terms with their universities and their communities. And it's interesting to me that you use this term, this politics of disappointment, that their disappointment with what the generations, their parents' generations, who they blamed for getting them into this situation and the inability of the state to resolve the problems. And one of the examples of these new approaches is what you call the quality protest. And that was particularly interesting, that it doesn't matter whether or not you have a lot of people. It matters whether or not you have the right people and whether you get attention basically from the media or from particular sets of leadership or institutions that you're trying to impact. So talk more about these quality protests. And I'm going to actually ask a question the way you phrased it in the book, which is who counts as a quality citizen in this type of protest? And why would a handful of these so-called quality protesters matter more than just a democratic mass of students in general?
No, that it's a great question. And it's interesting because I think that chapter and that notion of a quality protest and then my discussion of expertise in some ways get the most, I wouldn't say pushback, but the least sympathy. You know, it's interesting because when I wrote this, I have, this is true for anybody who spends so much time with a group of people or material, there's a sort of empathetic connection. And I thought that I was representing this much more empathetically or sympathetically than I was. And people often come to, but they're so elitist, right? And so much of that chapter in particular is trying to unpack what looks at from one perspective like an elitist position, right? Political position, a vanguard, right? They're sort of proposing the vanguard of good citizenship, of democratic citizenship, and it is to some extent. I mean, the history of the tension between a vanguard and a mass politics has always run along the lines of, you know, of the people versus the elites. This is not particular to this group, nor is it particular necessarily to the socialist and formerly socialist world, although it's an excellent example of the implications of those debates playing out in real world ways. But what I wanted to try to show was some of the logic and the rationale behind that kind of vanguard politics. And so the quality protest chapter was an attempt to try to grapple with the idea. Well, there are a couple of things. One is the mass protests. And I think this is a challenge for social movement folks and for activists, you know, across different social movement contexts. The mass protest is a very difficult form to sustain. Very difficult. And in part because it often tends to be reactionary in some ways, right? So the kind of galvanizing power of a stolen election produces a sense of community, right? That's going to be very different, in many ways necessarily different than the violation of a particular set of rights, for example, you know, the exam schedule at the university. And of course, it takes a tremendous amount of active ongoing coalition work to bring people out to the street, especially the more narrow the interest is defined. And so I think one of the things that these student activists were dealing with, in part because they bridged exactly that generation of mass protest to much smaller kinds of protests, was the social architecture and political architecture of protest, right, when that galvanizing moment is past. And so this is part of the revolutionary, post-revolutionary dichotomy that I'm playing around a little bit with. The revolution being signaled by the masses of people on the street and the post-revolutionary by these much smaller groups. The other thing I was interested in thinking about was how a post-socialist and privatizing state, in many ways neoliberalizing state in Serbia after 2000 and continuing today, parsed different interests or grouped citizens according to different kinds of interests, right? So it's a bit more of an identity politics paradigm that you're seeing in the quality protest. And that itself was also interesting to me, right? All of a sudden, instead of citizens, you had different kinds of citizens, right? You had students, you had workers, you had feminists, you had whatever, you had a variety of different kinds of interest. Now, people don't necessarily have to be at odds. Of course, coalitions get built all the time. But I do think there was something about the political economic configuration of privatization and the way that rights and entitlements were being distributed and that sort of thing that sliced people up. And you could see it reflected to some extent in the almost zero-sum game politics, where if I get this, you don't get this, right? So it became important for citizens to articulate specific demands rather than these kinds of collective and general demands. Again, a process that I think has a lot of comparative purchase in lots of different places. For the students in this idea of the quality protest, there was also a sense that if you were going to protest as, so students are a specific category, they've always been a specific category, they were a specific kind of category of rights-bearing citizens under socialism as well, right? They were special. They were the future. There was a tremendous amount of social and ideological investment in the idea of the student citizen, right? There's even a term for that, the student citizen. And so this idea of who counts and who doesn't count comes in part out of that tradition. It also comes in part out of a distinction that people used a lot in Serbia at the time around a kind of first Serbia and second Serbia, right? There was this idea of Milosevic supporters were the masses. They were who got us into trouble in the first place, right? And there was often representations of them as more working class, pensioners, more rural, more backwards. Their cultural and musical and aesthetic forms were often tagged among more elite university-educated folks as somehow being backwards. And so there was an association of the masses and certain kinds of class formations and certain kinds of politics. And then on the other hand, the idea that civil society was a middle-class phenomenon. It was an educated phenomenon, but it was also a more progressive somehow, politically liberal, progressive, and democratic kind of phenomenon. And so in part, the quality protest, this individual group of differentiated young students, right, that they're the future, they were setting themselves up against this idea of the mass, right? And so there was that was what was being performed in that protest a little bit. And again, it has these long, very, very long historical forms as well in Serbia, which I don't need to go into. But
and a lot of this protest, it was at this point focused on university reform, and the universities really become a site of revolutionary activity and revolutionary protest. And you mentioned already this idea of experts and expertise, mm-hmm. and that was the topic on which these young people are becoming experts, that though they are the ones who understand and are knowledgeable about and can articulate various approaches to reform, various issues within the university system as a space of oppression or as a space of not fulfilling its obligations to these students as citizens and as students. And a lot of that was centered around the work to get Serbia to adopt the Bologna process. So can you tell us about this Bologna process, this idea of a higher education area within Europe, why this was so important to Serbian young people and how they were able to position themselves as the experts to push this through?
Sure, no, it's a great question. Yeah, the idea, I mean, Bologna comes out, as you said, again, of this idea that if we create a higher education space, it will enhance and allow for student mobility across Bologna countries and across the continent. So it's a broader piece of a kind of Euro integration process. And also, it's supposed to streamline and rationalize and make more effective both university programs, but also transfers and exchanges among universities, right? The idea that if universities count their curriculum in similar kinds of ways, then it's easier for students to move back and forth, and everybody knows sort of what kinds of educational units count, right? And so again, it's part of a sense of an integrated European space, both in terms of employment, but also in terms of just intellectual exchange and other kinds of exchange and community. For many of the students for whom I worked, this idea of being integrated into Europe was absolutely central. They felt that, and in many ways it was true, Serbia had been isolated because of the wars, because of sanctions, because of the regime. Serbia had been isolated, and they had suffered tremendously for that, both in terms of the modernization of their education, the kinds of curricula, the kinds of ideas that they had access to. For example, things like interdisciplinarity was extremely hard to produce, to create interdisciplinary programs at the university because of very, very rigid curricular structures and also relationships among faculties, right? So Bologna would allow for a loosening or flexibility of curricular requirements that might allow for things like interdisciplinarity. I mean, to that point, alternative programs happen primarily, things like women's studies were run by academics, but they had to happen outside of the university at that point in time, at least. So it was a push for a more, what people saw as modern, more robust, more cutting edge, and more flexible and more practical educational experience. So that was one. The other was, of course, creating institutional linkages that allowed young people to do things like travel, to leave the countries. I mean, the visa and border regimes had been so stringent at that point that very few young people really had any kinds of opportunities to travel. And especially for university-educated folks, the importance of travel as the basis of a kind of cosmopolitanism, a kind of European identification and belonging, was really, really important. So Bologna was a sort of path to that as well. And then in addition, many students saw Bologna as a kind of lever, and faculty as well, and some administrators as well, as a lever or mechanism for Miloševićizing the university, right? I mean, for taking essentially an institution that had really come under the control of a highly politicized agenda and making it into a more intellectually critical, robust, and academic place. And so people saw these reforms. Again, as I was saying before, the ideas were very creative. The materials were often very dry and bureaucratic. This is where expertise comes in, right? So in some ways, the becoming experts on things like Bologna process reform allowed students to offer viable solutions to really intractable problems, right? Solutions that had the backing of Bologna countries, that had the backing of various European organizations, that had the backing of certain, you know, members, for example, in the Ministry of Higher Education. It allowed students to talk the talk and walk the walk in a way that actually got things done. Now, of course, the flip side of it is that, you know, lots of this material can be very, very dry and very legalistic. And so they were experts in something that they saw and was in many ways really critical for educational reform, didn't play so well, right, as a kind of mass rallying point, which gets us back to this whole quality protest kind of thing. And it really comes down to the question of, where do you locate social change? Who's your audience for social change demands, and what are your materials, right? And the way you will align those different things has real implications for what kind of movement you are, what kind of vision of democracy and representation you can offer. So as I argue in the book, expertise, many students saw who were activists that I work with, saw expertise as a really critical service that they could provide to other students to help make this institution work in a variety of ways. Many everyday students saw this stuff as highly bureaucratic, highly elitist, highly careerist, ironically very political, right? Because oftentimes it brought student activists to various meetings and high-level kinds of meetings and that sort of thing. And other student activists who said, you know, this is not what we're here for. We're here for, again, more rank and file kinds of, you know, commitments. Debates that, as I indicate, you know, in the book, and I've indicated other places, again, I think that have much more comparative purchase, right? If you look at the contemporary U.S. labor movement, for example, or you look at a range of student organizations that are now transitioning to political parties, right? For example, in Spain or that sort of thing. These are very weighty issues that these folks were working through.
And they were very controversial for the students, for the people who are watching them. And one of the things that I found striking about this politics of disappointment, it's not just that the students and the young people themselves were disappointed and therefore were engaging in these activities, but by their very act of moving into these realms of expertise and bureaucratic reform and legislation and regulation, that they disappointed others, yeah. that people who were looking to them to be the revolutionary vanguard didn't perceive these actions as revolutionary. And so that these students are also the politics of disappointment that they're engaging with or in this realm of people expressing disappointment with them. And that shows up not only, as you said, in the expertise, but also this as they become politicians, and I'm making air yeah. quotes for our listeners in the podcast, yeah. Because they really tried hard to, in a sense, depoliticize their role as politicians and kind of to portray it as a necessary evil, yeah. Because they felt this weight of disappointing others, it seemed to me. So absolutely. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think one of the things that's really important, and you spoke to that just now, right on, you know, revolutionary politics in many ways is a pure politics, right? And that's not necessarily true on the ground if you look at the anatomy and structure of what we call revolutions. But oftentimes it's easier to have a kind of ideological purity or a kind of set of commitments that seem pure in the heat of the moment, right? Of the revolution. And one of the things that was most important to me in this book was to argue that the end of revolution is not the end of politics, and that disappointment after the revolution is not failure, right? It's just that the terrain of politics and the condition under which you make claims and draw in audiences and develop coalitions and formulate goals changes really significantly, and it changes in a way in which that kind of absolutism or that kind of purity, if it ever even existed, right, is certainly no longer possible. And so in some ways that the trap of having to enact social change and yet not get caught up in the contradictions, right, not be seen as tainted, right, or no longer pure, is that politics of disappointment that I'm trying to get at. And I do think in many ways, and I say this not at all in a critical way, that democracy is really disappointing, right? Because it's really hard, right? And that a revolutionary politics doesn't always necessarily prepare, and again, this is not by any means a critique. These are different moments or different iterations or ways of being political, but a revolutionary politics doesn't necessarily prepare people for the grinding work right, of a kind of disappointing politics after the fact. And so this piece about being political and not political is incredibly important to that story and to what I mean by a politics of disappointment, which is that in some ways students were very well aware and others were very well aware that the altruism and the heroicism in some ways of a youth politics, right, that kept them seemingly pure, you know, in the moment of revolution, the unfolding of a kind of revolutionary politics, it was no longer possible to sustain those. And yet people would expect that of students, right? And so there's a lot of negotiation or tacking back and forth in really specific ways. And I hope the specificity of it and the strategicness of it comes out in the ethnography of trying to both create a sense of a pure politics or a democratic politics, right? And yet having to get one's hands messy and get your hands kind of dirty. And I don't know that there's a resolution for that for the students or for anyone. But one of the primary strategies that folks used, as you pointed to, was to try to draw distinctions between being political and being not political. And they did it in various ways. One of the ways that they did it, and again, just as an aside, the allergy to politics is, you know, the idea that to be political is to be immoral is quite widespread in the region for a whole variety of reasons. It's quite widespread in, I would say, the formerly socialist European world. It's frankly quite widespread a lot of places, right? I mean, we could certainly look to the U.S. and all of the various maneuvers and machinations that people go through to distance themselves from politics, right? The idea that politics is dirty, you know, is a really it's a profound rhetorical problem, right? As well as ethical problem for people. So, one of the things that students did, as I argue in the chapter that you're referring to, is to try to invoke regulations, statutes, laws, an almost legalistic commitment to procedure, right? Where if you could say arguably during the Milosevic regime, laws were fairly nakedly mobilized in the service of power, right? Part of the response to that is for laws to be, and that of course has interesting resonance in the socialist context, which I talk about as well. In among the students I was talking about, they tried to mobilize a notion of a rule of law, right? Which was a sort of architecture where they could take personal interests and careers and everything dirty about politics and hold it to one side and say, you know what, this is just about procedure. This isn't about my personal interests. This isn't about money. This is anti-corruption and transparent, and it's rule of law, right? So the idea of a rule of law was a kind of architecture for people to make politics a more ethical space for action, right? A more regulated space for action. Of course, the irony being that the involvement in precisely all of this kind of proceduralistic language oftentimes was read by other students and by adults and faculty and administrators and others as being really political, right? Either because they were involved in some sort of legislative process or because they looked so kind of nitpicky and so kind of expert that how could they possibly be the vanguard, you know, revolutionary student groups that we once knew and loved. One of the insights, of course, is that, you know, and this is probably obvious to say, procedure is never not substantive, right? Procedure and substance are always co-constituted, right, or integrated in some way. And so it was in part the attempt to proceduralize, substance kept leaking back in, right, and looking political. So I think that's a really interesting conundrum for these activists, but also for activists more broadly, for anyone who uses the law as a kind of tool for social change.
And a great example of how democracy never lives up to its idealized form, or these kind of institution building within democracy, that it is contradictory and flawed, is a conversation that you tell about, in which a student is just complaining about all kinds of things about the university, and you finally look at him and say, but this is the Bologna process. This is exactly what you fought for, and now you have it, and now you're complaining. And of course, that's humorous, but I think it really exemplifies this idea that democracy is a work in progress, and that it's not simply you have a revolution and you have people on the streets and you get democracy, or you get this kind of liberal democratic government and suddenly it all works. But we're constantly engaged in that process. And so looking at the situation today for young people and students and student activists, what do you see as their hopes and expectations and delusionments of this democratic process in Serbia today?
You know, it's interesting because I have to say I've tracked more with the folks that I wrote about in the book who are no longer youth activists in many ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're young, right? There are many of them are my age. I think I'm kind of young, not super young.
You can tell us about them.
Yeah, I have a better sense in some ways of what it looks like to grow up with this kind of politics than I do of how it's informed contemporary 22-year-olds, 23-year-olds on the ground. So I don't know that I could speak right now to what university politics looks like in Serbia right now as competently as I could speak to what kinds of lessons these folks have taken, right? And the kinds of politics that they've configured. Now, there is great, just, you know, future plug for those interested. There's tremendous amount of good research coming out of the region now about younger activists and a whole range of, I mean, it's a really exciting time to be thinking about alternative politics across the former Yugoslavia. There's the democratic plenums in Bosnia, which people are researching, writing about both in the region and outside. There's been massive protests in Serbia, massive protests in Croatia, all kinds of anti-corporate globalization kinds of movements. I mean, it's a very robust space for thinking through alternative politics, but other folks, I think, will can talk about that more than I can. From my perspective, one of the most interesting things, and I hinted at this at the beginning of the conversation, is, you know, this if it was a politics of disappointment, as it is a politics of competence now, right? That in some sense, I think increasingly, even more than that turning moment in 2003, my sense is people are looking around and saying, this isn't going to get done if we don't do it, right? Which is, again, the same kind of early impulse that I talked about when we spoke earlier when we were talking about the students then too, in terms of the pragmatism. And so just as a very brief example, you know, I've been following from a distance the activism around two things. One is the advocacy and activism around the wave of refugees that have come through, you know, because Belgrade and Serbia's right was on that Balkan route, and so, you know, there was a massive influx of folks through, and now even with a formal closing of the route, there are still people coming through. The bulk, as far as I can tell, the bulk of the organizing and advocacy is happening through an NGO world or volunteer world that is deeply informed by the experience of this generation of folks, down to either individual people who were involved then and are involved now, on through the kinds of lessons of self-organizing that I think came out of this period of activism as well. And I call it a competence, a kind of politics of competence, because people are continuing to make demands on the state and on politicians and through formal institutional challenges. But, you know, is, at least in the case of the refugees, they're also at a volunteer level taking up that work and getting it done, because I just don't think there's a tremendous amount of faith in institutions to really do it, you know. And I think that legacy of self-organizing, for better or for worse, right, because there are real implications about state-citizen relations and social welfare and those sorts of things. But I think that work of self-organizing is something that, frankly, people are really, really good at because they've been doing it for a really, really long time. So that's one piece. The other thing that's happening, as I indicated, you know, there have been huge protests in in Belgrade lately. I won't go into it in a lot of detail, but basically there's been a move to privatize and develop part of the waterfront. And there have been a variety of sort of a public private partnership with international foreign capital. But there's been a lot of concern about the transparency and sort of rule of law aspects of this development. And of course, it privatizes a area of the city, which has a tremendous number of public uses. It's also been a working class area, this sort of thing. It's a story we know from lots of the Gezi Park, right? I mean, there's lots of stories like this in urban privatization. But there have been huge, huge numbers, like massive numbers of protests, but not just protests, solid, many years of solid analysis, research, and coalition building has gone into producing the kind of public pushback and public protest that we're seeing on the streets, right, for example, of Belgrade now. And I think the lessons of long-term planning and coalition building and using regulations and using statutes and using expert analysis and networking with international groups, again, this isn't specific to Serbia, right? This is good social movement stuff. But I do think that those lessons very much came out of the experience of the 90s and the post 2000 world. So in some ways, to answer your question, people are feeling more frustrated. They're feeling more bleak. Economically, the situation continues to be extremely difficult, especially in the post-Great Recession. The refugee situation has been made things extremely complicated. Accession to the EU there's a step and then it gets pushed back. I mean, there's a whole range of things. Unemployment continues to be very high. I think there's a lot of frustration. At the same time, there's a lot of really good organizing going on. And so I think it's important to flag the how long it takes. Right? When we talk about a politics of disappointment, I think it's important to flag the layering of knowledge and experience and connections, right, that produce. We see on the news huge protests, right? What we often don't see is many, many, many years of that kind of groundwork and learning and coalition building. And so, you know, if people are interested, that's sort of where I would look to think about tensions between democratic politics and increasing, in some ways, state authoritarianism in Serbia right now.
And that leads in actually to my final question, and I appreciate the time that you've spent talking about this book with us, but we're interested in knowing what you're working on now.
Okay. So I am taking a little bit of a detour to work through and then come back to some of the themes that I've been talking about. You know, having worked in Serbia and in across former Yugoslavia and Eastern Europe for so long, and working in some sense in the margins of Europe looking in, and I have that in kind of air quotes, I began to be interested in, became interested increasingly in how it is some of these central contradictions around democracy, representation, particularly security and rights, were playing out in the so-called center. Right. And so what I'm now interested in, and particularly through the kind of language or idiom that I talked about of law and proceduralism, right? So what kind of creative world-making possibilities are happening in spaces that people often see as highly scripted, right? So legal spaces. So with that, I'm working now on a project on the European Court of Human Rights and looking at human rights adjudication in the European context and trying to think a little bit again about these similar kinds of tension. What is the relationship between law and democracy, for example? What is the relationship between some security and rights? And how is it that people are negotiating seemingly impossible contradictory demands, right, in the pursuit of democracy in contemporary Europe and using particularly these legal tools in order to do it? So I am currently on fellowship with the very kind support of my home institution, University of Illinois, to do a year of in the law school. And so I'm a law student right now.
Wow. Very, very interesting. And I'm sure quite an experience to be a student again yourself, as well as learning about the more technical aspects Well, great. Well, we look forward to seeing what comes out of this learning experience and research experience for you. And hopefully we'll be interviewing you again for the New Books Network in the future. But in the meantime, thank you again for taking the time to talk to us about the politics of disappointment in Serbia and youth activism. And I'm sure our listeners enjoyed your comments as much as I did and getting to know more about the book. And for our listeners, we hope that you'll join us again next month for another installment of the New Books in East European Studies podcast series. And we wish you all the best.